Lord God, please guard what we say here tonight. Keep me from speaking error inadvertently. Let me say those things that people need to hear. And open our hearts to be loving towards those who don't believe as we believe. Let us learn what we have to do as our part of the battle. Thank you, Lord Jesus. Amen. In the first verse of the first part of the book of John, you don't have to flip over to it because I'm not going to be here too long, so I'll just read it to you. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God, and all things came into being through Him, and apart from Him, nothing came into being that has been made. In Him was life, and that life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it. This is just an incredibly powerful platform that the Apostle John is building upon which to present his gospel. It's very different than, say, Luke starts out. Luke starts out and says, "Dear Theophilus, I'd like to tell you something." Okay, that's it. John here is, for anyone who has studied any of the ancient philosophy or the philosophers of ancient Greece, you recognize that he is beginning in the Greek rhetorical style to lay out a case for something. He does the same thing in John 1 when he starts right out. What was from the beginning, what we have heard, what we have seen with our eyes, what we have looked at and touched with our hands concerning the word of life. And the life was manifest, and we have seen and testify and proclaim to you the eternal life which was with the Father and was manifested to us. What we have seen and heard, we proclaim to you also, so that you too may have fellowship with us. And indeed, our fellowship is with the Father and with His Son, Jesus Christ. He's done another boilerplate opening there to lay the framework for what it was he was about to say. A few centuries after Christ died and went to the, went to be with the Lord, went back to heaven. Boy, those old reflexes kick in there, don't they? It's just really rough. That's all right. He went to be with himself. Okay. The church had a problem. They had a problem because all of a sudden they were reading the scriptures and they had to figure out what it was they really believed in some statement of faith, because already there were divergent views that were springing up that were sort of Christian, semi-Christian, and ones that were even questionably Christian, combining with some of the other philosophical worldviews of the day. Gnosticism, there was the Manichaean duality of that there is an equal struggle between light and dark, between evil and good, and that the spiritual part of Jesus was the good illuminated part, but his flesh was totally corrupt, and it went on and on and on and on. So the early church used to hold councils to try to figure out what it was they really believed, because communications was difficult. And one of the documents they came up with, there was an early document called the Apostles' Creed. A later document was called the Nicene Creed, because it was originally drafted. There were some precedent drafts to this, but it finally came out in the Council of Nicaea. And if you ever came from a liturgical church, you know exactly what I'm talking about, because you recite the Nicene Creed every Sunday. In the beginning was the Word, and I believe in one God, the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, and in all things seen and unseen. And it goes on, and it lists all these things that, you know, God from God, light from light, true God from true God, begotten, not made, one in being with the Father. Now, to us today, this doesn't always make a lot of sense. To them, every one of those phrases in the creed was something important about the nature of God or Jesus Christ. That he was God from God, he was light from light, he was true God from true God. Then it also says he was begotten, not made, meaning he was not born as a son at one particular point in time. He was always the Son of God, and that the Father and the Son were in an eternal begetting of each other in their relationship. Now, to show you how important philosophy is, there was one clause in the Nicene Creed, which is in Latin was called the Filioque Clause. And it says that the Holy Spirit, when it gets to the part of the Holy Spirit, it says that the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father, and the Western Church believed in the Son, that the Spirit emanates both from the Father and the Son. The Eastern Church did not believe that. That one clause was the theological root of the whole division of the church in 1054 A.D. between the Western and the Eastern Church. And it's called the Filioque Clause. Filioque means "and the Son" in Latin. And of course, the Eastern Church spoke Greek. The Western Church spoke Latin at the time. Worldviews are important. What you believe is important. What you believe affects how you will live. You know, just a couple of weeks ago, there was an announcement made that the human genome had finally been mapped in its entirety. This is a feat of some real accomplishment. It's billions of bits of code. It wasn't as long a piece of genetic code as they had anticipated. They figured, I mean, it was this almost like the same argument. Remember in evolutionary arguments, well, the more intelligent creatures should have bigger brains proportionally to their body. But they found out they didn't necessarily, that we're sort of paired with dolphins and other things. And yet dolphins can't write very well, but they're very intelligent creatures. And so on and so forth. So that didn't fly. The same deal. They found that the genome, the code is very short. There were two projects running parallel to each other. The Human Genome Project, which was publicly funded, and the same mapping project done by a company known as Celera Genomics. It was privately funded, and according to what I'm reading so far, produced a better map. But the two projects complemented each other in being able to compare the genetic maps. Now, the reactions of the different scientists to the genome mapping has really brought this whole issue of worldviews to light, because there are contradictory responses from scientists as to what this means. And these differences reveal an incredible growing chasm in the scientific community over the subject of origins and what some are actually calling the end of science. Scientists are more and more being confronted by the fact that science has utterly failed to answer the core questions regarding the origins of the universe and life, and the evidence is also contradicting much of what has been traditionally believed as Darwinism. Now, on the surface, and especially in pop science in the high school and in college, the old paradigm of Darwinism is still being thumped and preached as strongly as it ever was. But under the surface among themselves, scientists are already having doubts. And if you corner them at meetings, you can get them to talk about it. They will never do it publicly. It affects their reputation. It's almost the same situation as existed when Galileo decided to challenge the notion that the sun went around the earth, okay, in the whole Copernican debate. It's the same type of thing. And indeed, I talked to Dr. Stephen Myers at Whitworth College today about the situation. And he said, you know, they're beginning to make the same arguments, the same silly statements, the same irrational proclamations. He said that always reflects a worldview that is dying as it attempts to keep itself pumped up. And pumping up this thing while it keeps looking for an answer over here, hoping it'll find something before everything implodes on itself. There were two articles that came out on February 16th, and they were directly contradictory to each other. They did not feature creationists. They were scientists reacting to the genome mapping project. Now, the first article was done in MSNBC Online. It was written by Dr. Arthur Kaplan, who is director of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, in which the professor asserts that, quote, "The genome reveals, indisputably, and beyond any serious doubt," that's an important line, "that Darwin was right. Mankind evolved over a long period of time from primitive animal ancestors. Our genes show that scientific creationism cannot be true. The response to all those who thump their Bible and say there is no proof, no test, and no evidence in support of evolution is," he says, "the proof is right here in our genes." Now, he didn't say in the article that he wrote, it was a lengthy article, all he did was pontificate on how the genome mapping shows that Darwin was right. I kept looking for him to say why it shows that Darwin is correct. What he's talking about are similarities, and I'm assuming this from what I know about the project so far, but that there are similarities, of course, in our genetic structures and the genetic structures of other animals. And so the logical inference he is making is that because we have similarities and chunks of our gene structures that aren't needed anymore, but match genetic structures of earlier organisms, or what Darwinists believe are earlier organisms, therefore we evolved from them. Unfortunately, there's another explanation, that it could just be a designer who was using the same code over and over again because it worked. This is what computer programmers do. And you have to remember that when you're looking at the genetic code, it is a digital code. It is redundant, meaning it has duplications in case there are errors along it. It is error-correcting, and it is self-replicating, which no one has managed to do today in the computer world. It actually reproduces itself. And every cell in our bodies and in the bodies of every living thing has this incredible code all wrapped up in it. That's incredible. Another triumph of random chance. Okay. Now, from reading his article, and I read the article, you would just swear that science had once and for all proven the Bible wrong. But I should point out that Professor Kaplan did not work on the Genome Project. On the very same day, the San Francisco Chronicle published an article entitled, Human Genome Map Has Scientists Talking About the Divine. It featured an interview with Dr. Gene Myers, who was the computer scientist at the Maryland headquarters of Celera Genomics, who actually did the genome mapping. Now, here's what Dr. Myers said. Quote, we're deliciously complex at the molecular level. We don't understand ourselves yet, which is cool. There's still a metaphysical, magical element. Dr. Myers went on to say, what really astounds me is the architecture of life. The system is extremely complex. It's like it was designed. Now, the interviewer asked him about this. He said, well, doesn't that imply a designer or a deity? And Dr. Myers responded, he said, well, there's a huge intelligence there. I don't see that as being unscientific. Others may, but not me. Now, to me, this was really profound. Because here you had the same result, the genome mapping project. You had one scientist saying absolutely positively, this shows that Darwin was right, we evolved by random chance. And the man who actually did much of the mapping himself saying, this is a pretty complex piece of code, and it looks like somebody designed it. How is it that you could reach two conclusions out of the same piece of data? The answer is the worldview of the people involved. How you view things, the things you assume to be true in your world about you, it can be called a worldview or a paradigm. A paradigm tends to be the worldview of a culture, right? So when we talk about the new paradigm, it's the new collective culture. That's why Jesus at one point said, these people have eyes, but they see not. They have ears, but hear not. Why? He was right in front of them. Why? Because their worldviews, the things they assumed to be true and false, prevented them from understanding the reality of what was going on right in front of them. Let us review, for those people of you who were not faithful enough to be here last week, let us review for about 5 or 10 minutes here what we went over, okay? Everybody has a Weltanschauung. You're supposed to be taking notes. Weltanschauung, okay. As bad as it sounds, you can't get rid of it. It's the German word for worldview, and it's the term that philosophers use, okay? Good, bad, sloppy, or formal, everybody's got one. The Weltanschauung determines how we view ourselves, the world, and God, if you happen to believe in God. The goal of any philosophy or religion is to answer several basic questions about our worldview. Number one, who are we? Two, where did we come from? Three, where are we going? Four, what shall we do while we're in the process of going there? Number five, is there a God? And there are three corollaries to that. Number one, what is the meaning of life? Number two, what about the problem of evil? And number three, what is the nature of reality? Now, process of applying our worldview is two-sided. There was a philosopher by the name of Immanuel Kant who made a very perceptive statement. He said, concepts without percepts are empty, and percepts without concepts are blind. That sounds pretty thick. I had to think about it the first time I read it myself. And what he's saying is, if we have conceptions up here, but we have nothing to back it up in the real world, he said they're empty. Because you and I can imagine all sorts of things that just aren't. This perhaps is where the fallacy is when someone says, visualize yourself and make yourself the God you want to be. Well, I can visualize myself doing that. There's that Lexus I wanted. You know, I can do all of that. It doesn't make it real. The flip side of that, he says, percepts without concepts are blind. That means many people are staring right at something and have not the vaguest notion of what it is they're looking at. I've pointed that out to people. If you're ever standing on a high mountain, you can actually see the curvature of the earth if you know what you're looking at. The fact that the ground seems to rise up from right at the base of the mountain and roll up higher and higher until it reaches the horizon and then crosses what's called the tangent point. You're actually looking at the curve of the earth moving away from you there if you know what you're looking at. The weirdest place you can ever see this is by the ocean. And if you come over Portola Drive in San Francisco and look out toward the ocean looks like it's as high as you are, and all of the houses on the west side of the San Francisco look like they're below sea level. You keep wondering why the ocean doesn't rush in, and that's what you're looking at right there. So they have eyes, but they see not. And so what he's saying is these two things have interactive principles. And in Christianity, my belief is, is that both of these conditions can be satisfied in the faith in God and Christ, that there is no contradiction between what I see in the real world and what I know to exist in the spiritual world. Okay, all of these issues have serious consequences. They have built or destroyed the lives of millions of people and continue in the process of doing so today. Two, they affect the eternal destinies of these people. And let me say it again, the discussion of religion and philosophy is not idle speculation. It has very real consequences. The fact that Satan has convinced so many people that they have their truths and we have our truths, and therefore no truth need to be examined because we create our own truths, is one of the greatest tragedies that ever happened. It has actually constructed a wall of genteel hostility that is incredibly difficult to break. In the last century, and I'm talking about starting at the end of the 19th century in through the 20th century, the world in the West made radical changes in its paradigms, in its presuppositions about reality. They are as follows. Number one, the world moved from a belief of absolute truth to a belief in relative or multiple truths, and constantly changing truth. Two, the world has shifted from a logical way of thinking, a systematic way of organizing your world, that everything you believe about your world, as much as you can do it, has to be coherent and consistent and logical. Now, none of us is perfectly logical. There's only one person I can think of that is, who understands everything and comprehends it. But we try. We know that there is an ultimate ideal out there. That's the Christian worldview. And that we're trying to achieve that ideal. At one time, we had a relatively common worldview in the West, and all of our political, philosophical, theological, and ethical debates revolved around how we interpreted the worldview or how it could best be implemented in politics. What we have today in the West, whether you're in the English-speaking world, and it doesn't matter which English-speaking country you live in, or parts of Europe, we are now seeing two competing worldviews vying to the death for control over the hearts and minds of the Western world. And as it is doing so, the worldview of secular humanism and Christianity, there is a third competitor which is emerging because of the fact that secular humanism as a belief system is collapsing. But it's going down kicking and screaming, and it is morphing as we watch it, to use a term from the movies, into what I am calling global pantheistic socialism. Because the one thing that humanism has failed to do is to answer all of those questions that I listed above. And so now people are turning to religion again and to gods and goddesses and all sorts of things. And the new government that is emerging is socialism. So indeed, it's pantheistic socialism. And we will deal with that not this week. Whenever you listen to a speech, whenever you listen to a sermon, is I always ask the question, so what? If I can't answer that question at the end of a speech or a talk or something that you've done, I'm getting to the point that I resent it because you've wasted my time. Time's the only thing we have. Do you realize time is the only thing we can buy and sell? Really? We all come here with a given allotment of time. It ticks by. Well, I know there are differences in time, but for all practical purposes, for those of us here on Earth, it ticks by at pretty much the same rate, plus or minus a few microseconds, depending on your latitude. I'm sure God will take this into account. And everything that you do, your work, your play, your following the Lord, whatever you do is measured in time. And I always ask, so what? What does that mean? You have got to get it down out of the heavens, so to speak, out of the theoretical and back into the practical. And so I always try to answer that. All right, what are the competing worldviews? Let us move on here. There have been three main competing worldviews in the 20th century in the Western world. Number one is Marxism. Number two is secular humanism. And number three is Judeo-Christianity. Now, there are other religions. We acknowledged that last week. But in the Western world, those have been the three competitors. The Western world has pretty well developed the modern world that we know it as today. Marxism and secular humanism are really kissing cousins, because they originated from the same set of philosophies. There are distinct differences between them, but in all functional reality, as I said last week, the only real difference between Marxists and socialists is that a Marxist is a socialist in a hurry with a gun. Okay, that's the only difference. Because the functional effect of the worldviews is to pretty well be the same. Let me show you some of the areas in which all of these worldviews function. Okay, in theology, both humanism and Marxism are atheistic. In philosophy, the humanists believe in naturalism. That means we sort of make it up as we go along here. The Marxists believe in dialectical materialism. There's not a big difference between those, and I don't have time to go into it. In law, they both believe in positive law. That means there are no eternal values. We simply establish the laws and lex rex. He who is the king makes the rules. In biology, the secular humanists believe in gradual Darwinism. The Marxists tend to believe in punctuated Darwinism. So they came up with a new concept called punctuated equilibrium. It went in quantum leaps, and that fit the model of the Marxist revolutionary idea. Marxism is about constant, continual revolution. In economics, they both believe in socialism. In sociology, the humanists are anti-traditional morality and sociology. The Marxists want to abolish home, church, and state. Functionally, it's the very same thing. In politics, the humanists want to see a socialist world government. The Marxists have always wanted to see a new Marxist world order. Same thing. In history, secular humanism believes in evolution. Marxism believes in dialectical revolution, constant fight. There were some differences. In psychology, humanists believe in monism, meaning there is no difference between the mind and the brain. They believe in self-actualization, that people should all try to reach their highest potential. The Marxists believe that we are the result of our genetic programming, that we respond simply as programmed machines with no free will. And in ethics, the humanists are relativists and the Marxists are proletariats. In other words, the proletariat is always trying to overthrow the bourgeoisie. What in every single Marxist revolution that's ever been there, the bourgeoisie is the middle class, the proletariat is the underclass. And in every revolution, the Marxists that overthrew the bourgeoisie simply became the new bourgeoisie. And the proletariat was just as bad off as they were when they started. There's not been an exception to that, that I know of. And they've tried it over and over and over again. One of the places that Marxism is alive and well is on American college campuses and Canadian campuses and in Western Europe. Despite the fact that it's failed over and over and over and over and over again. Marxists are terrific at overthrowing governments. They're lousy at running them. Okay, what is the Christian context? Theology, what do we believe in? We have a theistic worldview. We believe in a God. Philosophy, we believe in supernaturalism, not naturalism. That there is a spiritual reality behind the things that are going on. In law, we believe in a biblical and natural law. It's biblically based, but there is a natural law that is inherent in every human being that God put there. Paul talks about that, that everybody is given this basic knowledge of some kind of a moral structure. And believe me, from culture to culture, it's almost the same. Everybody believes that murder is wrong, that incest is wrong, that lying is wrong, that stealing is wrong. Somehow, we just seem to instinctively know that these things are a law, and from which came English common law, as opposed to the civil law which we have here today in this country. In biology, we believe in creationism and purposeful design. In economics, rather than believing in socialism, where the state owns or controls everything and wealth is redistributed, Christians believe in the stewardship of property and private ownership. The Bible is very clear. God wants property to be delineated, the markers of property were not to be moved. In commerce, we were to use fair weights and measures. Nowhere does God say, go and choke the snot out of somebody and take all his money to give it to somebody else who needs it. Nowhere are we ever instructed to do that. Okay? That's why there are attempts to reconcile socialism and Christianity. Because socialism says it's going to do good things. Okay, but the problem is socialism always does good things with somebody else's money. See? There are three E's to a socialist. Number one is elitism. He's elite. He has the great view. I call it the vision grande du monde, okay? The great vision of the world. Okay, number two, basically, to sum that up, he knows, you don't. Number two, the second one is expropriation. They're going to carry out their vision grande with somebody else's dinero, okay? How's that for mixing French and Spanish? And number three, exemption. They are always exempt from accountability and from the consequences of the things they lay on top of you. I challenge you. I mean, I made those rules up quite a ways back, and I keep trying to disprove them to myself, and I keep seeing them get fulfilled every time I turn around. It just happens. And that happens in bureaucracies, by the way. Some churches function like that. In any kind of a bureaucratic structure, a school system, a government, whatever it is, those three rules will almost invariably function. The dilemma that I had in trying to do these talks, as Rabbi Zacharias said, it's trying to get a drink from a fire hydrant. You turn on the tap, but you don't get quite what you expected. You get more than you can possibly handle. And so what I have done is I'm going to throw out Marxism. We've seen its effects. You're generally not going to run into flaming Marxists, except in a few cases. And then their beliefs are so close to socialism and humanism that you can deal with it. Secular humanism is the predominant worldview and religion of the United States, Canada, Australia, Europe, South Africa, and New Zealand. So tonight we will take a wonderful romp through the world of secular humanism. It is the predominant thought and religion of all of our secular college and universities. It is also making substantial inroads on Christian colleges and universities as well. Marxists and humanists have always recognized the value of seizing control of the education system. As far back as 1913, John Dewey, father of public education in our country, and others literally declared war on the Christian paradigm of the culture. Now, the church at the time just yawned and ignored them. And the way they said they were going to do this is simply begin educating a new generation of educators who themselves would get more followers believing in the system, who would ultimately transform the culture. This is different than the Marxist approach, which is to run in and shoot everybody who doesn't agree with you. Okay, that's probably the key difference between humanists and Marxists and what they do. Humanists also have a better conceptualization of the worth of life, but they're very mixed up about it. That's the difference. They believe in the potential of the human being, that each human being should self-actualize himself to his ultimate potential. The Marxists believe that everyone is to serve the state and that all are expendable in the name of the Soviet, the collective. That's the difference between the two. I wanted to read some quotes from people because this will give you an idea of how far back and how wide-reaching this has been and how much has been accomplished today. In 1932, William Z. Foster was national chairman of the Communist Party in the United States. He published a book called Toward a Soviet America, in which he called for, and here we go with the quote, a U.S. Department of Education, implementation of a scientific materialist philosophy, studies should be revolutionized, being cleansed of religious, patriotic, and other features of the bourgeois ideology. Students taught on the basis of Marxian dialectical materialism, internationalism, which today we would call globalism, and general ethics of a new socialist society. Present obsolete methods of teaching will be superseded by a scientific pedagogy. The whole basis and organizations of capitalist science will be revolutionized. Science will become materialistic and truly scientific. God will be banished from the laboratories as well as from the schools. That was 1932. That's all happened now. In 1919, almost, I would say, a decade earlier, the Progressive Education Association was founded by John Dewey. The goals and aims of the organization for the latter half of the 20th century were determined at a meeting in Chicago, which took place between November 15th and the 17th in 1943. They were published in the PEA journal Progressive Education. This is a global war, and the peace now in the making will determine what our national life will be for the next century. It will demonstrate the degree of our national morality. We are writing now the credo by which our children must live. Yes, something happened around a table in Chicago. An organization which might have become mellowed with the years into futility, in three short days again, drew a blueprint for the children of the world. Once again, the church yawned. In 1932, the National Education Association created the Education Policies Commission for the purpose of changing the goals of American education. In 1944, over a decade later, the EPC published a work entitled Education for All American Youth. What did this book call for? Number one, federal programs for health, education, and welfare combined in one giant bureau. Two, Head Start programs. Three, getting preschool children into the system so they could be indoctrinated as early as possible in the new method of thinking. Four, teacher participation in curriculum design. Five, federal funds without federal control. Ironically, that didn't happen. Education in this country has now been effectively centralized in the federal government. Local control is an absolute joke. It does not exist anymore. Youth services through a poverty program. See, that's when you hear about the Clinton youth, if you recall that. I say it because it's like the Hitler youth. Okay. Removal of local control of political and educational matters without seeming to do so, and sex education. That was back in 1943. By 1946, Major General G.B. Brock Chisholm, he's an M.D., he was Deputy Minister of Health, Department of National Health and Welfare in Canada. And this is for the benefit of our Canadian listeners. He wrote an article entitled The Psychiatry of Enduring Peace and Social Progress. In March of 1948, the article was reprinted in International Conciliation, published by the World Health Organization, the leading promoter of abortion and other types of things, and the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. which was exposed during the Reese Commission hearings in Congress as working using tax-exempt funds to try to completely change the American way of life from a capitalist to a socialist system. Most people have never heard about the Reese Commission hearings in Congress. It included a preface by Alger Hiss, former president of the Carnegie Endowment, later convicted of spying for the Soviet Union. Dr. Chisholm said, "The reinterpretation and eventually eradication of the concept of right and wrong, which has been the basis of child training, the substitution of intelligent and rational thinking for faith and the certainties of the old people, these are the belated objectives of practically all effective psychotherapy." This is a declaration of war on Christian belief. He said, "Would it not be sensible to stop imposing our local prejudices and faiths on children and give them all sides of every question so that in their own time they might have the ability to size things up and make their own desires? If the race is to be freed from its crippling burden of good and evil, it must be psychiatrists who take the original responsibility. The people who matter are the teachers, the young mothers and fathers, the parent-teen associations, youth groups, service clubs, schools and college, the churches and Sunday schools, everyone who can be reached and find help toward their intellectual freedom and honesty for themselves and for the children whose future depends on them." He says the battle, if it is to be undertaken, will be long and difficult, but the truth will prevail whenever enough people want it to do. He said, "With luck, we have perhaps 15 or 20 years before the outbreak of the next world war." He was wrong about that, since obviously we're long past that. "If we remain as we are, 20 years in which to change the dearest certainties of enough of the human race." And those dearest certainties that he's talking about is religious faith. "And destroy the oldest and most flourishing parasitical growth in the world, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, so that many may learn to preserve his most precious heritage, his innocence, his intellectual freedom." That was another shot across the bow against Christianity. All right, as we said, secular humanism is the predominant worldview of the Western world. It shaped our society. What does it believe? They've come out with three humanist manifestos, 1, 2, and 3. The first one was signed by people such as John Dewey. Here's what it says. "The basis of humanist belief is that there is no Almighty God, the creator and sustainer of life. Humanists believe that man is his own God. They believe that moral values are relative, devised according to the needs of particular people, and that ethics are likewise situational." I might inject here, that is why we're on this floating moral ocean we see in politics and everywhere else in the public arena today. "Humanists reject Judeo-Christian moral and ethical laws, such as those contained in the Ten Commandments, calling them dogmatic, outmoded, authoritarian, and a hindrance to human progress." I always like reading that line. I always think of the time when Moses went up to the mountain and disappeared for a long time, and the people got restless and they came to Joshua and said, "Hey, we don't know where Moshe went. Build us a calf." These commandments, you know, authoritarian, dogmatic, outmoded. "In humanism, self-fulfillment, happiness, love, and justice are found to be each man individually without reference to any divine source. In the Judeo-Christian ethic, there is and can be no self-fulfillment, happiness, or justice on earth that can be found which does not ultimately issue from Almighty God, the Creator and Sustainer." You know, at least they got that part right. Okay. I want to focus tonight on ethics, morals, and psychology. There are other areas like politics and the nature of economics, but I want to focus more on this because this is where humanism really shows itself as a religion. After rejecting God, humanists had two alternatives that they had to deal with. How were they to establish? They had to build an entire moral system on their own. I mean, after all, we have the Judeo-Christian system that was functioning quite nicely. They were rejecting that, but they had to come up with something that would replace it. The first effort was something called ethical relativism. It maintains that the notion of right and wrong varies from situation to situation, and it's relative within a certain context and a certain culture. No eternal truths, no natural truths, no God-given truths, simply constantly changing truth. Well, this was the preferred method of humanists. Most of them have clung to this. It has been a spectacular failure in producing an ethical code, since there has been an endless stream of squabbling among humanists as to what ethics should be in and what ethics should be out. Now, originally, humanists, when they first started up, believed that reason and experience would form the basis for moral conduct. This is always the argument that you hear. Last week we talked about legal creep, and I pointed out that a legal creep is not an attorney, okay? This is when we begin to challenge what a law says and sort of push it a little to the side, one way or the other. And it's usually in the name of a good. Evil in the 20th century has frequently ridden in on the back of a white horse, a real or contrived problem that did need to be solved, but the solution turned out to be worse than the original problem. So they say, well, we can handle this. We're intelligent people. We can manage our lives. And so the law is twisted here. But as soon as you open that door towards whatever change, it isn't long before anything keeps on going. And before you know it, you wind up at places at the end where the people who started at the beginning would never dream or admit that's where we were headed. You know, a perfect example of legal creep is in our currency here. I don't have any in my, and I was going to pull some coins out. Almost all the cultures of the world have begun with gold or silver currency. The reason we have gold or silver currency is the fact that remember the requirements for money. It has to be scarce. It has to have perceived value. It has to be durable. It has to be, like I said, scarce. So gold and silver fit the bill. So does platinum. There have been lots of things used for money. And so they will strike a coin. Then the government ultimately wants control of that. Rather than letting the people control their money, the governments of the world, going way back into history, will always come in and begin minting their own coins. Now, the governments have big appetites. They always do. When have you ever heard of a government scaling back? It's unheard of. In Washington, a tax cut means they just don't increase spending anymore. That's the definition of a tax cut and for that much in Ottawa. I call it Ottawa-Washington because they both function the same way. We need more money, so why don't we just debase the coinage? And what they do is they begin, they say, okay, this is an ounce of gold. Okay, what if we just made it 75% gold and 25% base metal? It would still look goldish, and it would hold up, and it would have gold value, blah, 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 so and so. Well, the temptation is irresistible, and as time goes by, finally, the coin is worthless. And according to Gresham's law, by the way, bad money drives out good. And so when we did the same thing the last time we had precious metal in our coinage, if you recall, they had the great changeover under the Nixon administration. And sure enough, overnight, all of the silver quarters and half dollars and dimes went, psh, disappeared right out of circulation. Why? Because the people aren't stupid. They know what's happening. And they know that this dime is worth more than this plug dime over here. That's an example of legal creep. And it happens in all sorts of directions, whether it's the abortion issue or the rights issue or the Bill of Rights or anything there. As soon as you crack it open one way, just over a period of time, it will inexorably move downwards. And it always does. It always moves to our basis nature as humans. Well, anyway, they believe that reason and experience form the basis for moral conduct. They said, as long as mankind pursues activities that are healthy, socially useful, and in accordance with reason, pleasure will generally accompany them, and happiness will be the supreme good that comes from them. Well, okay, that sounds good, and I guess if everybody out there on the street were always every day deliberating, let's talk today about what's good and what isn't good. You want to talk about that, Joe? Nope. Rather talk about football. Okay. First problem with that, what happens when you and I are both in a moral situation with each other and we both reason through it to different ways? Humanists have been able to arrive at any system on which they can all agree, but if they can't agree, how can you have an effective moral system? The second argument you can be made against this is that for a large part of the population, they don't care about reason and experience. It simply acts on its baser instincts. It does what it thinks is best for itself at that moment in time. Now, there was another form. So the humanists realized they had a problem. They said, if we just say we make it up as we go along, everybody makes it up as it goes along. And to quote Sam Hayakawa, he said, in a society where anything goes, nothing goes. And what typically happens in that case is it all deteriorates into tyranny. Because as a result of the lack of uniform moral perception and law across the society, chaos begins to reign. It's exactly what you're seeing in our culture today. Chaos begins to reign. And ultimately, the chaos gets so bad that the only way to stop it is with an iron fist. And sooner or later, somebody appears, or some group of people appear, more than willing to impose the iron fist and pull it together. The Christian view of culture is that we all believe that there is a God who sees us, whether anybody else does or not, who knows what we do, good or bad, who will hold us accountable for that, and because of that, we all have our own internal moral compasses. And the external law only reflects what we already believe internally. And therefore, you only need a legal structure to catch those people who did it. You can see the difference in law enforcement change nowadays. In this culture, we used to assume someone was innocent until proven guilty. Now, technically on the books, we still do that. That is, unless you're accused of something involving a civil crime like forfeiture or something like that. Then it flips over. And the goal was for the police officers, the federal agents, to go and apprehend those people whom, once the evidence surfaced, had committed a crime. That was the purpose of law enforcement agents and officers in this country. Now, this has drifted. The whole notion of law enforcement has changed because, again, what happens? As soon as you have chaos, you have to have more law and more law and more law. It begins to multiply. And then we have to figure out who's breaking all these laws. So I guess we better have all this snooping activity. See, now we have switched, and you can even hear this in statements made by police officials around the country at various times. Their goal is not to apprehend those who have committed crimes, but to prevent the crimes. That's a radical change in thought. Because now, in order to know what all these potential citizen criminals out here are doing, we have to know what all the citizen criminals are doing. And the only way to do that is to know everything about everybody. And that's sort of where we're headed right now. That's as a result of this. So anyway, humanists needed a bigger system. They had to appeal to something higher than them, but not too high. If you went too high, there's God. Can't have that, so they came back down a bit. So they said, okay, evolutionary ethics. Since situational ethics proved to be a difficult task to master, some humanists posited the existence of a higher moral code. They said, which was lower than God, but above mankind. They didn't quite put it that way. That's my read on the situation. But it has evolved with the human race as we evolve from earlier primates and from earlier life forms. Evolutionary ethics is what this is called. It said the morals are higher than our race because of the fact they evolved with us and they govern us, and if we're smart, we'll listen to it. Well, evolutionary ethics has its problem as well. It attempts to say that the morality which we seem to recognize and do is the result of centuries of human evolution. But you know what the problem is? According to Darwinism, evolution features survival of the fittest. And that means if you can punch my lights out, you get to have your morals prevail over mine. And so the whole thing deteriorates very fast into what? Survival of the fittest, morality of the fittest, or what was called lex rex. Okay, who's ever got the power makes the rules, or else. That's it. The other thing that humanists always tend to do is they tend to borrow from Christianity. They've actually recognized the fact that throughout almost all cultures, there are moral laws regarding murder, theft, sexual mores, cowardice, lying, etc. But they've never managed so far to put together a moral and ethical system, which is why humanism is collapsing slowly. That and the lack of ultimate purpose in life. We'll look at that just a little later. And it's rolling over. So the humanists are holding on tenaciously, but we are in the process of change right now, and it's literally a moving target. When evolutionary ethics failed, most humanists fell back on their moral relativism, and that didn't prove anything meaningful. What did this do in the real world? Well, we've seen what it's done in the real world as far as the disruption of society, the disruption of the education of the children, the failure to train in moral and ethical values in the schools, and the new morals and values that are being taught, and they are being taught. And that's the problem I have with nationalized testing, is that 50% of these tests right now are psychosocial in nature, to see if the children and their families have politically correct thinking. This has been uncovered in a number of states by a number of different people, such as Steve Ray and Anita Hoag, who have been taking legal action because it actually violates federal law. Humanists played a big role behind the sexual revolution. Alfred Kinsey, of course, remember the Kinsey Report, in his studies, which have subsequently been proven fraudulent, concluded that homosexuality was a biologically determined lifestyle from birth. You know who his test populations were? Prison inmates who were in there for sex crimes. You never hear this much from the Kinsey Institute, you know. This is where we got the 10% of the population have homosexual tendencies. In reality, it's about 1.5%, 2-3% in concentrated areas like San Francisco or Greenwich Village or other places like that. Humanists have played key roles in agencies such as Planned Parenthood. Margaret Sanger, Margaret Calderon, Faye Waddleton have all been part of the organization.
This is the end of side one. Please turn the cassette over at this time for the continuation of this message.
Margaret Sanger was a racist. She was a eugenicist. She instituted her birth control program among minority groups, for the most part, in the inner cities to limit the reproduction of the inferior races. She collaborated with some of the Nazi eugenicists in Germany in the 30s. But now that racism is not, well, it's not kosher anymore, it's not politically correct, Sanger's background and beliefs were never mentioned by Planned Parenthood today. That was their founder.
Planned Parenthood's publication says, which is entitled, You've Changed the Combination, says there are only two kinds of sex, sex with a victim and sex without. Sex with victims is always wrong. Sex without is always right. What they're talking here is the concept of consent. Is the sexual thing forced and does it harm anybody? And of course, an unborn baby doesn't count as to far whether an abortion that's the result of that affects them. You know, we've been dealing with the core problem of all humanist ethics, which can be centered around one single word. This is the problem of all morals and ethics. The word is ought. Sometimes it's a substitute word. It's shall or should. And sometimes a moral law has the negative counterpart. Ought not, should not, shall not. Now, as soon as you say ought or ought not, what's the first corresponding thought in the mind of the oughtee? Okay, the one to whom you are directing this command. He says, who says? Isn't that the first thought? Little kids? Well, who says I got to do that? I don't got to do that. Well, my dad. Well, your dad. Well, him. Right? Same thing. You know, to this day, humanists have never successfully answered that question. Nor have they provided an adequate substitute. Will Durant is a well-known historian. I don't know if you ever saw his voluminous work, The History of Western Civilization, that he and his wife Ariel co-authored. I always recommend it. I say you are reading a secular and somewhat humanistic work, but it's still a very good history of Western thought, especially. But he wrote an article in The Humanist back in the early 1970s entitled Humanism in Historical Perspective, and he admitted, he said, there is no significant example in history before our time of a society successfully maintaining moral life without the aid of religion. Okay, and according to Dave Noble at Summit Ministries, who quoted Durant, Durant said, later in his career, Durant reiterated this belief, saying that it would be difficult for humanists to mold a natural ethic strong enough to maintain moral restraint and social order without the support of supernatural consolations, hopes, and fears. So even Durant was admitting, we can't do it. We are now seeing the wreckage of this century-long experiment at putting humanist morality into the culture. Remember, in Humanist Manifesto 1, they said they rejected God, and they claim man himself would be able to provide adequate substitutes. They have utterly failed to do so. And that's good news. It really is. They had their shot. They had their moment in the sun. A lot of people out there are disillusioned, misdirected, flowing without a compass. This is a great time if Christians know where to jump into the gaps and begin to address these issues. Because you can't hate these people. I don't disrespect these people. I don't disrespect the professors who profess it. Occasionally I think some of the things they believe are silly, and I don't always enjoy it when Christianity is attacked, but you got to get a tough skin. You can only take so much of it anyway. After a while, I talked to Dean Gocher about he reads what they're doing in the consensus process and how it is just absolutely diabolical and how it's invading the churches and what it's doing to our democratic form of government. I said, how do you do that? He said, I can only read the materials for about 30 minutes at a time, and I got to put them down. He said, it's so bad. When you realize what's really happening here beneath all the pretty words and everything. And he has to pray a lot. In Christian ethics, we believe that God exists. This is our counterbalance to it. And we did a brief proof of the existence of God last week by St. Anselm's called The Evidence of Design, which the Human Genome Project is really confirming. A code that is billions of bits long. And remember, a code is neither periodic nor random. Periodic means it occurs. That's periodic. Because there are things in the universe that are periodic. Pulsars put out periodic things. Planets rotate in periods. All sorts of things happen in periods. Sometimes in exclamation points. That's called a catastrophe. Okay. Nor is it random. You know, it's really weird. Let me explain to you. One of the things that they're trying to do as far as evolution is concerned is posit, okay, well, we can't figure out where we came from, but maybe we got planted here by some UFOs. Okay, this is called, Carl Sagan thought this idea up. It's called directed panspermia. I don't think this one pans out in the end, to be honest with you. But it says basically, we got plopped here by UFOs. We're the product of a much more mature, much more enlightened generation of UFOs out there. That shoves the problem back maybe a few more billion years or a few more generations to another star system or something. But it still ultimately doesn't answer the question, where did they come from? But when we have the SETI project, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, this is a serious project. they are looking for signs of extraterrestrial life. What are they looking for? And they're looking around the frequency of the hydrogen atom. This is a universal constant. They're looking for coded information. They're not looking for periodicity. They're not looking for randomness because they know the code is a sign of intelligent design. And yet the very same people are trying to do that so they can prove that the coding in the DNA structure doesn't prove that we were designed by a deity. It just inherent contradictions in their thought. The moral order was created by this God who is. That's the next thing Christians believe. It flows from the Creator. It exists outside of man, but is somehow inscribed into his very nature. All right. Number three, it exists in a vague way in the natural law contained within each creature, and specifically in the law which has been given us by revelation. Four, morality is not arbitrarily created by God, but it flows from his very nature. It is part of him. His nature is holy. It cannot tolerate evil or moral indifference. And all the moral characteristics we can think of, justice, holiness, love, faith, hope, mercy, forgiveness, kindness, and truth, are all characteristics of the moral order because they are primarily the characteristics of God himself. There is accountability for complying with or failing to comply with this moral code. We call it judgment. There's a process by which we can get off the hook and have meaning, and that is salvation. You know, it's interesting to note that, as I said earlier, humanists are always borrowing moral ideas from Judeo-Christianity. There has actually never really been a new moral code proposed on the face of the earth. All of the new secular codes that have come down are either extensions of or eliminations of the previously existing code. No one's ever come up with a new commandment, so to speak. When a culture moves away from God, the first generation is basking in the security of the culture that it is within. Usually it's a time of economic prosperity or solidity and stability. The same analogy I use is the concept of a household in which the mother and father are there. The children grew up in a relatively stable home. They have the security of the home. Even when they move out, they know they can always go home if they have to. It's a psychological place that they can go to. So in the first stage, the first part of the culture speculates. Well, what if? It's like Satan in the garden. Did God really say? That was the first dialectical dialogue. Do you know that? That was the first dialectical dialogue that ever existed in history. He didn't come in and challenge God. He questioned the interpretation of what God had said. It was, how you define shalt not? Okay. In reality, what he said is, you know, we will be like gods, and you're right. If you read that carefully, it's just very subtle, very slight twist. That's why this whole consensus process, the whole dialectical process of ethics today, is nothing but an extension of what happened thousands of years ago in the garden. The culture can actually begin to speculate because it doesn't suffer any consequences right away. Okay, it's got a stable culture, got stable homes, stable environment, stable everything. And it can launch out into the new system. It's sort of fun, you know. We can go out, we can speculate. Look at how young people are when they're in college and they're speculating in philosophy classes about all these things. Now the second generation, however, we got a problem. Say, let's use for example marriage and divorce. Generation one, stable marriage, had a couple of kids. Those kids get married and they get divorced. Now the divorce is a painful process. It's not fun. But they can always go home, can't they? They still have mom and dad. Both the spouses have mom and dad, stable home. But what about their children, generation number three? See, they're the generation that began to suffer from what happened, not in the previous generation, but in the one before that, in what we call the penultimate generation, the one before the last one. And by the time you get to four, chaos is in order. Nobody's staying married, no families are stable, etc. Sometimes it takes longer. That's just a universal procedure. That's what happens as cultures move away from the Lord. It takes a while, it takes generations before this stuff takes hold. If you read the history of ancient Israel, you can see this process at work. And no matter how far down the stairs they go, even when you have people such as King Josiah come along and they manage to reverse some things and shove it backwards a bit, it never goes back to where it started before. And it always comes down to the final point, as it does with Windows, and you have to reboot. Okay. That's what the Tower of Babel was all about. It was a reboot. That's what the Flood of Noah was. It was a reboot. That's what the final deportation into captivity was for the people of Israel. It was a reboot. Guess what? One more time we get another reboot, God says. That's what the whole book of Revelation is all about in the end times prophecies. Maybe the bottom line in the humanist versus the Christian ethic is that Christian ethics represents God's efforts to reach man. Humanistic ethics represent man's efforts to reach or be God. That's the difference. One starts from the inside out, the other says the inside's corrupt, and you have to come from the outside in. Now, a companion piece to this is psychology. Psychology is the religious form of worship of humanism. Even our court system today worships at the altar of psychotherapy. Humanists assume that man is the product of random generation and billions of years of evolution. This is why evolution is so important to humanists. Without it, they have no way of explaining how we got here. That's why everybody's very nervous. Under the table, so to speak, scientists, many of them, are concerned. They're beginning to see the implications of what they are discovering. The latest discoveries are just proving the things that Darwin believed in the beginning, and they're pointing towards other things. And then the reaction to that is just incredible. It reminds me of somebody defending their theory of the rapture, because they're virulent about it. Ever watch different people with defending their views of eschatologies, and they've got their timeline charts and this or that? It's fun. I don't get into those anymore. But that's what you're seeing, is they're defending it virulently. As soon as someone even dare mention God, they're all over you like a bad smell. It's almost a level of hysteria. Abraham Maslow, a leading psychologist and the founder of the hierarchy of needs upon which most of our modern education is built. Everything you're seeing in Goals 2000, outcome-based education, is based on Maslow, Rogers, and Skinner. It's all psycho-operant conditioning of our children. Maslow said that humanists for thousands of years have attempted to construct a naturalistic psychological value system that could be derived from man's own nature without the necessity of recourse to authority outside the human being himself. Maslow actually went on to admit that all of these attempts have failed. But he doesn't allow this to discourage him, but he says that certain developments in the science and art of psychology in the last few decades made it possible for us for the first time to feel confident that our age-old hope might be fulfilled if we just work hard enough. What he's saying is science has finally plopped in their hands the tools to try to do what humanists have wanted to do all along. Humanism has had to confront the realities of its own theory of origins. It said that mankind was evolved from rocks dissolved in seawater, energized probably by lightning strikes or electricity, as produced by the random changes in the genetic sequence. How's that for a 4 million year history of it? As such, the direct implication was that man had a deterministic nature, being the direct product of his genetic coding. Humanists had a second problem. If we are machines derived by our coding, then are our actions determined, and we are therefore not responsible for what we do and what happens to free will. And the humanists don't like that because they believe we're supposed to be climbing to our highest level of self-actualization. It really destroyed free will. So in contradiction to everything else they believed in other areas, they rejected the concept of determinism, which the Marxists did accept. They liked that. So the humanists came back to the notion of whether mankind is intrinsically good or evil, or simply, as the philosopher John Locke said, a tabula rasa at birth, a blank slate, upon which would be written the experiences of the life that the person lived, and he or she would react and learn accordingly to that. Humanists basically believe that mankind is intrinsically good. They attack the Christian notion of sin. Humanist Wendell Walters wrote that the Christian is running furiously on a treadmill to get away from whole segments of his or her human nature, which he or she is taught to fear, or about which he or she is taught to feel guilty. The Christian is brainwashed to believe that he or she was born wicked, should suffer as Christ suffered, and should aspire to a humanly impossible level of perfection nonetheless. Strangely enough, there's an element of truth in that, depending on which church you're looking at. He also said a true Christian must always be in a state of torment, since he or she can never really be certain that God has forgiven him, or her, for deeply felt negative feelings, in spite of the Catholic confessional and the fundamentalist trick of self-deception known as being born again. Enter Abraham Maslow, the foundation upon which most of our psychosocial engineering was based, as I mentioned. Maslow said the purpose of each person was to get in touch with his real self. He called this self-actualization. He established a hierarchy of needs, which had to be met in sequence. First of all, they were physical needs. Second of all, safety or security needs. Third of all, love or social needs. The fourth were the ego or status needs in society. And finally, it's almost like nirvana, you could achieve self-actualization if you had totally gotten in touch with your inner self and you were doing everything to your full potential. Maslow himself said that very few people are ever self-actualized. He even had a hard time identifying people in history who were self-actualized. Under this psychological scheme of things, man is constantly becoming. So the goal of this type of thinking is not to encourage a static type of personality based on traditional notions of right or wrong, but the kind of person who can go forward into the uncertain future. We'll go back to the Israelites at Mount Horeb, and anytime anybody wanted to go bravely forward into the future, something went radically wrong each time, because you were basically chopping yourself off from the moral constraints that held you there. The definition of mental illness, and this is important, by the way, I don't know how many people realize when Hillary Clinton and Ira Magaziner failed to get their health scare program through a few years ago, it's just been chopped up and it's being passed through in bills that have thousands of little segments of it, whatever. The new definition, and even President Bush is talking about this, is mental health. Now, when you hear the mental health buzzword, you and I probably think of not having neurotic behaviors or things like that, all right? That's pretty much what you think of. Their definition of mental health is being politically correct within the norms of what they determine to be correct, the humanist view of what mental health is. And that if people don't go along with that, you are mentally ill. You know, in the Soviet Union, the biggest instrument that they ever used to persecute dissidents in the Soviet Union, and I'm thinking of Sakharov and Natan Sharansky, who's now in Israel. Sakharov is dead. They were called the refuseniks in the Soviet Union, was to put them in mental institutions. Because anybody who was too stupid to see the wisdom of communism had to be mentally ill. That was the rationale behind it at the time. The definition of mental illness is based on how well someone is attempting to achieve his or her self-actualization. Any behavior or belief that does not, in consonance with that self-actualization, is mental illness. The man of the future should be self-actualizing. This means he should ever be moving toward a greater realization of his human potential, and equally important that he be constantly transcending himself. And what they have said is that Christian belief or Jewish belief, or frankly the other religious beliefs of the world themselves, are impediments to the self-actualization, and therefore people are mentally ill. And I believe it was Brock Chisholm, I couldn't find the quote before tonight, who said that when children come to school, they're mentally ill because they've been filled full of ideas by their parents. And that's why the push as far back as the early 30s to move education as early as you could get it, because they understood, the humanists that were beginning to control academia and the colleges and the teacher schools began to understand that you had to get the children as early as possible to get them away from the influence of their parents. That is why even today we see the flip over in the emphasis of parenthood. At one time, it was viewed that the parents were pretty much the ultimate people responsible for the upbringing and the care of their children. That the teacher was a temporary representative of the parent for the time that the children were in school. Now, when I grew up, that's the way it was. But now we keep hearing the word partner. We're partnering together to raise your children. It takes a village to raise a child. That's what we're talking about. See, this whole thing is an interlocked net. It's not a bunch of random things by accident. It's not a conspiracy either. It's not like somebody's going into a dark back room with cigars and visors and a naked light bulb hanging there saying evil things and incantations. These people have been very open about what they intend to do. It's just that very few people, Christians included, are reading what they're saying, especially in their speeches or their articles. And there is today an interlocking web, there's no time to go into it here, you could do a whole evening on it, between the Department of Labor, the Departments of Education, UNESCO, the United Nations Organization, and a whole interlocking series of foundations and laboratories and other educational, private educational organizations, and there is literally what I call financial and economic and educational incest going on. Because they are all exchanging money, they are exchanging personnel and whatever. This cadre of a large number of people are determining the education policy of Canada and the U.S., and we're all marching in lockstep to the same beat. And the states are coerced into going along with it because the federal government comes back and dangles, and this is the way it works in the U.S., it's different in Canada, but the federal government comes back and dangles money in front of them and says, "Would you like some candy?" You know, and if you want the candy, you have to do certain things. You must conform. When they say all students shall, they mean all children. And that's why I keep warning homeschoolers and private schoolers, you will not be exempt from the laws that have already been passed And most of them are just beginning to be implemented. The control of the education in this country will be determined by what are called exit outcomes or standardized testing. They'll leave the homeschoolers alone. They'll leave the private schoolers alone. But all children will have to pass these standardized outcomes. And 50% of those will be psychosocial. The databasing is already in progress. It's well underway, in which their politically correct attitudes, what their families think, you know, about various topics, et cetera, et cetera. Very intrusive questioning. It's already going on. And there are some suits to stop it right now. Steve Ray was a congressional candidate in Ohio, and he has a website called optoutohio.com, I believe it is, in which he's got a lot of the documents up there showing this. Anita Hogue did this. The whole story of Beverly Eckman's first book, Educating for the New World Order, details the Anita Hogue story, who one day, when her daughter came home and said, "We did this and this and this." You did what? And going from being a house mom, she went to a major campaigner and demanded to see that. You know, it's amazing. Do you know how hard it is for the parents to see the tests or what their kids are being given in school? Okay. So we have changed radically. But this was the humanist vision. You know, I read you that material from back in 1933. This is it. The tragedy that I always say is we have lots of Christian teachers in public school who do not understand that when they went to teacher college to be certified, to get their certification for teaching, they were actually being brainwashed into a humanist method of thought. And they don't actually see, I've talked to teachers before, it's amazing, they do not see the contradictions in the systems. And even though they don't think they're implementing this system, they think they're bearing witness to Christ in the school, in reality, they're implementing a whole different agenda. And I can't ring this bell any harder. I've been trying for 10 years. Back in 1993, you know, the briefing pack, The Truth Behind Outcome-Based Education, we produced in Denver, Colorado in 1993, I think in July, it was a hot July afternoon at Channel 2, and we had Barrett Chose and Charlotte Iserbeet, who used to be with the Department of Education, and several other people, and they outlined where education was going. You know, I hadn't listened to that tape in years, and about a year or two ago, I threw it back on the machine just to see it, and it was haunting, because everything they had said back in 1993 has now been implemented. So the whole thing was an agenda. It was put through in several stages. It was put through in stages because you see you can debate stages. Outcome-based education. Why did you need OBE? They would say, well, the standards aren't working. Oh, horse pucky, the standards always worked whenever you taught. When we taught mathematics, when we taught history, when we taught these things, when we taught spelling, when we taught reading on the phonetic system, it worked. But OBE was needed because we needed to move off a fact-based system and move on to a perceived-based system, in which outcomes and social attitudes could likewise be programmed into the mix. Because they knew that later on coming down the pike would be school to work and careers and all of the other things that were in there. This was all well known. You can find all of this in the education literature. It was just the public didn't know. And the legislators in the state legislatures didn't know. And the Congress people didn't know about it. That's the only difference that happened there. Christian psychology, what is the view of that? And we'll wrap it down and I'll show you what the bottom line is. It's important to recognize that in the Christian versus the humanist view of things, the church does face an alternative plan of salvation. There are rival doctrines as candidates for the salvation of humankind. Humanist psychology assumes that the state of man is best when it's most in touch with his inner nature. That's the perfected or self-actualized person. So all secular psychology seeks to do is bring people as closely in touch with their flesh as possible. Now, this is a profound implication because there are sections of psychology that are worthwhile. When we're dealing with physiological problems, learning disabilities, a few things like that, there are parts of the psychological profession that are relatively scientific. But when we start to talk about theories of mankind and of personality and of what mental dysfunction is, which constantly changes, by the way, American Psychiatric Association keeps changing its definition of mental illnesses and what is a mental illness and what isn't. And then some mental illnesses have been declassified. When was the last time you ever heard of anthrax being declassified as a disease? Name one disease that was ever declassified as a disease. See, it's all a matter of wet your finger, stick it up in the air, and define it. So the only thing psychology can ultimately do in its humanist incarnation, how's that? In its humanist incarnation is to bring people back to the very fallen sin nature that God said is the problem in the first place. That's why it always fails. Psychotherapy generally has very little effect on people. People can be in psychotherapy for years. And all it keeps trying to do is getting them back to their flesh without producing the change that God wants to produce in us, that the Spirit is capable of producing. Even by their own standard, psychotherapy has failed. All right? A monist believes there is nothing more in a human being than brain. that everything we are is brain. Christians don't believe that. We believe we have a body, a soul, and a spirit. And there are even scientists who admit that when you do posit the theory of a spirit or soul which exists in connection with the body, that it helps answer a lot of the problems that they have, trying to understand how, say, a human mind can appreciate music or perceive things that are complex. There are other issues there that just a bunch of synapses going doesn't really answer. Christians believe that the part of us which is really soul and or mind continues to exist after the hardware that we're in. Remember, the software, as Chuck would say, is up here. But after the hardware dies away, we continue to exist. We do not cease to exist. That mind exists even in a better state than it does now. Well, let's bring it down to the wire. How well did humanism do? Let's go back to those questions I said every worldview has to answer. Who are we? Humanists say we are machines that are the product of genetic coding that is developed by random chance over millions of years. Where did we come from? Rocks dissolved in seawater, activated by energy, probably electrical. Where are we going? Nowhere, but you can be self-actualized and fulfilled while you're going there. I like that one. I giggled when I wrote that today. What shall we do while we're here? Only what we believe to be worthwhile from our own self-centered point of view. There are no rules except to fulfill ourselves. Go shopping. Wait a minute. Let me write that in here. Hold on a second. Go shopping. There we are. Okay. Is there a God? No. Okay. Corollary 1. What is the meaning of life? Only that meaning we give ourselves. Corollary 2. What about the problem of evil? Life's a bummer. Then you die. Get used to it. The universe is meaningless and there is no one at home in it. C. What is the nature of reality? Matter and energy, nothing more. Now, they tried real hard. You have to give them credit for it. They tried real hard, but they have failed. That is why the world is now evolving. I always flinch when I use that word for some reason. I don't know what that is. That's why the world is now evolving to a new paradigm. We are moving back into a religious paradigm. That's what makes me very, very nervous about public-private partnerships, because I know that President Bush did not think up public-private partnerships. Just like the educational issues, this has been in the works for a long time. And the new paradigm has a religious component, only it is politically correct religion. And politically incorrect religions, orthodox religions of Christianity, Judaism, and Islam especially, will not be tolerated under this new paradigm. The new system is seeking to co-opt religion. Before they tried to stomp it out of existence, not only did they not succeed in doing that, they also failed to answer all the questions that you or I really want. Let's face it, if we're all that is, and this is it, and the time is ticking away, and we are and we die after that, don't you think any talk about having a meaningful life is sort of stupid? Rise to your highest ideals. Why? Why bother? Nothing's going to be on it. Well, think of your kids. Yeah, but they're going to die and rot too. Okay? I mean, this is the crassness of the whole situation. But in a Christian worldview, the whole thing is flipped over. I mean, I can't find where I put my whole thing here that was flipped over there. There are three rules in public speaking or doing radio work. Number one is don't make a mistake. Number two, if you make a mistake, make it look like it wasn't a mistake, like it was supposed to happen. And number three, if it's really obvious that you can't do that, laugh a lot. You know, I just... So what's the Christian worldview if we go back and ask these questions again that we asked earlier? I want to read something that Francis Schaeffer did here. Where are we here? Now I'm totally lost in my own material here. Isn't this awful? Yeah, reboot. All right. Christian view, who are we? We are what? Individual human beings made in the image and likeness of God. Where did we come from? God. Where are we going? In our case, God. Okay? What shall we do while we're here? Why, golly willikers, there's a whole pile of stuff we're supposed to do while we're here. Okay? And if you ask the question, why should we do that? Well, it's not just because God told us to do. You know, we don't do it because if you're saved by grace, you don't do it because God is going to slam this giant hammer on your head. You do it because God did something so wonderful for you that it's your natural response to what He did. And it has purpose. I can raise my kids knowing that I'm going to hand this baton to these children and that hopefully they will hand it to their children even when I'm gone, but that I have purpose and reward in that and in my recognition of God, and they likewise have purpose. And we all know that in the end, everything's going to burn. Here on earth, everything burns, right? Okay? You know, remember the millionaire J. Paul Getty? You know when he died, do you know how much he left behind? All of it. Okay. My mother was his secretary for a number of years. She showed me a postcard one day written to her by J. Paul Getty, and it was written when he was in Nazi Germany on a business trip in 1936, had a big picture of the hotel with the flags, Nazi flags. I said, don't ever get rid of this. This has got to be worth something, you know. But that's it. We're here, we do it. And that's why, again, the same thing you see about the whole urgency of the humanist or the pantheistic viewpoint of environmental stewardship. They say what? We are on an equal par with all the other species of the earth. Therefore, we have no rights, no precedence, and it is arrogant of us to intrude ourselves upon them, and we have to save the planet, save the earth, save the universe, save the this. Whereas the Christian says, we are the stewards of all creation as God gave it to us, and we must take care of it. Doesn't mean we're supposed to be environmentally irresponsible. But the whole attitude and the process that results from those two different views are different. And we know that in the end, all creation groans for redemption, and the rest of it all burns, as Peter tells us. All right? That's where we're going. What is the meaning of life? Well, our meaning of life is God. What about the problem of evil? In the next couple of weeks, we'll talk about the problem of evil. It isn't just a bummer, get used to it. God says all things work for good for those who are called. Okay? For those who love God, we're called according to His purpose. So even the evil that happens to us happens for a reason. It happens as a result of our sin, both the sin that we commit against each other and the fact that natural disasters occur as well. Okay? Because all of creation fell because we made a fatal choice. And do you know why sin exists? Sin exists because God chose to give us the gift of free will. He had to give us the option to have creatures to love Him. He had to allow us the chance to fail. I remember one time a man who just had some children, and we'd already had two, and he was telling me, he says, well, God only does good things for me and this and that and blah, 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 and He'd never let me get into this situation, blah, blah, blah. And I thought, okay. And he said, well, you've got kids, so you never want to see them get hurt, do you? I said, yeah, I do. And he looked at me really shocked, and he said, you do? I said, yeah, I want to see them get hurt. I don't want to see them get killed. And that's my job, is to be there. I said, because when they get hurt, they learn and they become tougher. My job is to see to it they don't suffer destruction. That's the difference. And to know that there's always a bounce back. And that's what God does with us too. That's the problem of evil. It's a bigger problem than that. We'll deal with it. What is the nature of reality? Well, there is matter and energy, but as God tells us, everything we see around us is simply a reflection of those things going on in the spiritual. Francis Schaeffer told us, many sensitive people today are really struggling for their lives and asking the question, what is the purpose of man? In fact, modern man has not come up with a satisfactory answer to this question in any of his fields of thinking. It does not matter much whether he has approached it along the lines of naked rationalism or the leap into the dark of modern secular and theological mysticism. 20th century man has failed to answer this question. He said, when someone asks me the Christian answer to this question of purpose, the reason for man's existence, I always take them to the first commandment of Christ. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, and with all thy soul, and with all thy mind, and with all thy strength. The Christian sociological position is that the sociological problems which exist, regardless of what they may be, are a result of the separation that has come between men because of sin. And now the world should be able to see in the church external marks which show that there is substantial sociological healing possible in the present generation. He said the Bible does not promise us perfection in this life, except in the area of justification. It does not promise us perfection morally, physically, psychologically, or sociologically. There are moral victories and growth, but that is different from perfection. He said, but people can be helped wonderfully psychologically, but that doesn't mean they will then be totally integrated and totally self-actuated personalities. And he finally said, it is hard to understand how an Orthodox evangelical Bible-believing Christian can fail to be excited. The answers in the realm of the intellect should make us overwhelmingly excited. The answers in the realm, but more than this, we are returned to a personal relationship with the God who is there. And if we are unexcited Christians, we should go back and see what is wrong. We are surrounded by a generation that finds nobody home in the universe. And that's why you should get out there and give them heaven. Thank you.
For a complete listing of materials to further enhance your personal Bible study, or to receive a free one-year subscription to Chuck Missler's monthly Christian Intelligence News Journal, Personal Update, contact Koinonia House at 1-800-KHOUSE1. That's 1-800-KHOUSE1. Or you can write to Koinonia House at P.O. Box D, Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, 83816-0347. To fax your correspondence, dial 208-773-6312.